I'm Susan Lube for Women's Focus, and today I'm talking to Mira Jacob. I'm talking to her from New York, but she comes from New Mexico and from Corrales, actually. Welcome to Women's Focus.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
I've just finished reading your book, and I just loved reading it. It's a story of a family from India that comes to New Mexico and sort of becomes part of a larger circle of families in New Mexico, and you sort of develop the story over the years. You said in your acknowledgement that the book took you 10 years to write the book. And rather than saying you spent 10 years on the book. And so I was thinking that expressing it that way might mean that you had a story that was kind of roiling around inside of you for a long time. It was hard to get down. Or also, it's a very complicated structure of the book. And I wondered if maybe that was what took the 10 years.
Oh, those are great questions. Actually, though, what happened is just... It's just life. What happened was life. Here's what happened. I started out with a book in which I knew that the father was going to be receding in some way. This is a family story. It's a story about, obviously, a people that come from a place that is other than New Mexico and make a life in the desert. And so along with that, I knew that the father was going to be receding in some way from the world. This is what I kind of knew when I started, and I wasn't sure exactly what form that was going to take. I thought maybe he would have Alzheimer's. I wasn't quite sure. So I was 3 years into writing it, and I had this wonderful character for the father. I was really attached to it, and then I got a call from my parents in Corrales, and they said, Dad just got back a test, and he has cancer.
Mm.
And he had renal sarcoma. And, you know, I did what all people do when they hear horrible news like that over the phone. I was with my husband, who was also from New Mexico, and we were in the frozen food aisle of a grocery store, and I don't remember how we got out, and I don't remember how we got home. I kind of remember the next thing is that he was sitting next to me in bed and saying, you know, this is just early stages, you know, he's going to be okay. But what happened was he wasn't okay. He died over 3 years. And he was a doctor, and he knew what was happening at every stage.
Oh,
and
boy.
Part of that was, oh, it was so painful. And part of the pain of that was knowing that he knew more than I did about what was happening and that he was trying to prepare me for it in some way. He took care of us, his family, the way that he did his patients, which is that he really looked out for us, and he was really trying to lead us slowly toward this thing that I think he knew pretty much right away was going to be happening. And what happened in the course of that, and I think anyone that's lost someone to cancer knows this, is that you carry this enormous hope with you the whole time. You mm-hmm. have to go into those hospital rooms and into those dark hallways and all those places. You just have to have a lot of hope. And the weight of that hope is tremendous. And while I was carrying around that hope, I really could not begin to carry this story. So I put it away.
Oh, that's what I was wondering, was whether you used it as a way to work through your feelings or, of course, you must not have been able to write at that time.
I couldn't write anything. Because, as you know, writing really requires a kind of emotional work. Especially when you're writing fiction and you're writing characters, you have to have this distance to create a real world and to let that world exist. I didn't have any of that in me at that point. But what happened was, so my dad died in 2006, and I pulled the novel back out in 2007, and I started writing it. But every time I got to a scene with the father, I kept writing my father instead of the father that I had created for the book. It was so crazy. I would look at the computer and I would start typing and I would start imagining, but every time I would imagine, that character was just gone for me, and in its place was my father and his mannerisms and the things I missed so much at that point, just, you know, that kind of grief
mm-hmm.
Of not having someone with you. So I wrote him. I just decided, and it was very funny because I came back to Jed and my husband, and I said, oh my God, I'm ruining the book. I'm ruining the book. I have this great story. I have this great father. I really like the other father, and then I keep writing my father, and I'm losing my mind, and this book is going to be terrible. And he said, so why don't you just write your father? And I said, because it's against the rules. He said, whose rules? Which is maybe the nicest thing that anyone's ever said to me. It was really, it was this great moment because I just sort of had a, I had a breakthrough when he said that. I thought, yeah, whose rules? And I also thought, yeah, I miss my dad. I just get to do whatever I need to do. Mm-hmm. I just get to do whatever I need to do to get through this. So the characters is really funny amalgam because none of those things happened to my father. He didn't have that kind of relationship with his family. He's a, actually a very different person than the man that's in there, but the mannerisms are his. The way he moves through the world, that's my dad. The way he spaces his sentences, yeah.
The hospital seems to take a big part, too, and I think that must have been true in your childhood with him.
Absolutely.
As a doctor.
Yeah.
Such a,
absolutely.
It's sort of always in the background and big.
The hospital was, for me, it was my father's other home. Mm-hmm. You know, he lived there, and he had a family there. And when we walked through those doors, people greeted him like he was a member of their family. And actually, when he died, when he was dying in his last kind of days, he actually came home to die. But there was a moment where we were in that hospital in Presbyterian for the staff that I will forever love, and there was a point at which all of those nurses came and stood in a line outside his door because they knew it was the last time they were going to see him, and they just came in one by one, and they were so quick. They were just, it was this beautiful thing where they understood that he had a limited amount of energy, and they just all wanted to give him his love, and they just came in one after the other after the other, and they held his hand and they kissed his cheek and they walked out. It was just this gift for all of us to see that. And I understood as they did that they were losing, you know, they were losing a member of their family too.
Well, we should at this point, I think, talk about how much of the story is autobiographical and how much isn't, because you kind of apologized to your sister and your brother at the end of the book. For
My mother and my brother.
I'm sorry, your mother and your brother at the end of the book for what the world was probably going to think.
Yes. Well, the entire time that I was writing it, my mother was hilarious because my mother's like, is the mother me? Is the mother me? And I was like, no, it's really not. And I don't think she ever believed me until she read it. And then when she read it, she said, oh, the mother isn't me.
So it's not like you're trying to psychoanalyze your mother.
No, not at all. And in fact, the mother in this book is one of my favorite characters, and she is so dominating. I mean, incredibly dominating. She is the immigrant that comes to America and can never find her footing there. And actually, my mother is really the opposite. My mother found her footing early on. She loved America. She loved feminism. She loved New Mexico. She loved driving. And they had a little VW bus at that point, and they drove all around the country. And, you know, she was a real adventurer. And she's also the person that introduced me as a young person to a lot of culture. She really, that was her thing in life, is that she's an intellectual, she's very political, and she was always showing me, this is how this person feels, this is another story, this is another way of looking at things. Where Kamala, the mother in here, can barely begin to get her head around this idea that there's any other story but her own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, that's why I think I had the apology in there just because she's so the opposite of my mother, and my poor mother is going to have people giving her all sorts of looks
like they know
something about her.
Yes.
I know. I feel so bad.
Well, did you actually go to India and to see what it was like in India? Did you have a chance to do that?
I've been to India many times.
Oh, okay.
I've been there to India. Yeah, I go to India. When I was growing up, I went every other year.
Oh.
And now I go probably once every 3 or 4 years. But I've been to India many, many times. So it's part of a distant home.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the structure of the book, because I really liked the structure of going back and forth in time and back and forth in place. And although I have to admit that I cheated towards the end, because you you would end at a certain place, and it was very dramatic sometimes. And then you'd sort of go back to another place to explain what was happening then. And I sort of looked ahead and kept reading.
That's great. I love that. That's great. I made it very easy to do that. But that's the first time I've heard that. I'm delighted that you did that.
And then I'd go back and follow along what you wanted. But let's talk about the structure, because it must have been hard to manage all those people and different times and different places.
Oh. Well, let me tell you a story about the structure, which will put it into context. So I wrote this book. I was laid off over here from my job, and I had 3 months in which to write this book that I would be collecting basically severance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had been working on this book for, 9 years from like midnight until 2 a.m, and all of a sudden I had 3 months, and I knew I had to get it done. And so I was in this dead sprint, and I finished it. I got laid off in the beginning of April. I finished it. This book, the last entire quarter of it, I finished it within a month.
Wow.
And it was part of it is that all the story had been lining up and it was dying to come out of me. Those last 3 years of work were just torturous because I would just think about this book constantly. So part of it was that. I mean, someone put me down in front of a computer at that point and I was like, just everybody shut up and I'm going to get this done. But the other thing that happened is I finished it and my agent said, if it's ready to take out in June, we'll do that. And I gave it to her, and she called me, and she said, I am the biggest fan of this story. You know that it's not working.
Oh.
And I knew it. I knew it when I'd sent it to her, but I didn't really want to hear it. But she said it to me, and I said, yeah, why not? And she said, well, it just sort of dies in the middle. And the way that it had been structured before was that you come in present day and you find out, you have the one little glimpse of India. You find out what is happening in the family. And then all of the stuff that takes place in the 80s in New Mexico, all of that happened in one big chunk in the middle.
Mm.
And then you went back to find out what was happening with Thomas. So, she said that. Talked to another friend over here who is an editor who said, I don't really know what the answer is, Mira, but I almost want to tell you to, throw the whole thing in the air and shuffle the chapters. And I don't know, but she's right. It dies. And I said, yeah, that's helpful. it was one of those things where I was like, everyone is giving me the knife to the gut, but I hear you. And then I was talking with Jed, and I said, okay, and the other thing I should tell you is the book was 800 pages as opposed to the 500 that it has come down to now. So.
Wow.
It was 800 pages at that point, and I was talking to my husband, and I said, I kind of know what needs to happen, but it's so big. It's so big that I can't get my head around it. And he said, well, why don't you storyboard it? And I said, what does that mean? And he took me into his job where he had storyboarded a film and said, well, this is how I do it. And he had stills and he had note cards, and I don't have stills to work from, obviously. But it was so funny because when he said that, I just instantly saw it in my brain. I saw, oh, this is what's going to crack the code of the book.
Oh, great.
And I went and got a bunch of colored note cards. And I sat on my couch and I wrote out. I broke it down into chapters. Then I put this huge map up on my living room wall. I can send you a picture because it's pretty funny. It's basically these stripes of every different timeline, and then I just started moving them back and forth, and I kind of felt like the Russell Crowe character in A Beautiful Mind, where I was like, this could be insane, I don't know what's happening, am I talking to imaginary people, it's entirely possible, but I did it, and it was great, because it enabled me, one, to cut out a lot of filler,
mm-hmm.
A lot of stuff that wasn't absolutely essential, that I just loved, because I loved, but, lose it, and the other thing is it helped me see this thing, this sort of secret in the story that I hadn't quite understood in the way that I did when I began to map it out, which is that this is this story of two mysteries. And I use that term very loosely, but it's the story of two people in a family that have lost their way and kind of their undoing and the family, the
and
way that the family reacts.
It's at different times.
And it's
at
different
say that.
Times.
Yeah.
And it's, yes, and it's different times, and it's 20 years apart.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's different heartbreaks, but they're very similar in another way. And once I began to plot it out, I understood that very quickly. And so it was just moving back and forth between each which for me felt absolutely good, absolutely necessary and good.
Well, let me tell you what my experience was. But first, I'm talking to Mira Jacob, and we're talking about her book, The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing. It's a novel that's just come out, and she's going to be signing it, reading from it, and talking to people about it, and signing it at Bookworks on July 22nd. And we'll tell a little bit more about that later. What the experience that I had was I started reading the beginning, the very first, I don't think it's even the chapter, I think it's a prologue.
And, yeah, it's a prologue.
And then I thought, oh, this is so difficult. You know, it's interesting, but it's hard to keep the people straight, and it's hard to keep what's happening straight because it's in a different culture. And if this is going to be the way it goes through this book, which is very long, it's going to be hard. And then I think I said to your agent after I'd gotten into it and the structure sort of took over, the rhythm came, and it was a whole different experience.
Hmm.
So I like what you do. I think that they were giving you the right information and doing the right thing.
Yeah.
So another question I wanted to ask was, what made you decide to make the main figure?
Amina,
to make her a photographer.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think in scenes.
Yes.
My writing, if you noticed, it's very short, sharp scenes, even though it's a long book. And I process most things visually. And it made sense to me that the way that this person, who has been really formed a lot by a pretty intense past, the way that she would get through that is by becoming this kind of uber observer. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing to me also about photography is that it is an action that is both aggressive and passive in the same instant. You are watching, but you are also choosing what you're getting down. And kind of the aggression of it is often hidden, but it's absolutely there. So it made sense to me also that this character that had been shut down on many emotional levels had this very aggressive side, which is her ability to kind of unflinchingly look at things.
Mm-hmm. The reason I asked that question is because the book is very visual and very rich visually, and also as far as sound is concerned. And then the photography kind of adds a different dimension, a different way of looking at things, because it's just something that happens at one time. It just captures that one moment. And so it adds this whole different dimension to what you're visualizing in your mind as you're reading it. And I thought it was a wonderful choice to make for her.
Thank you. Thank you.
And as I said, the visual part is wonderful, and also the sound. If I could just sort of use some things that from the book, you talk about the bleat of a fairy or the crinkling sound when someone, and you find out that someone's opening a piece of gum, or the phone that's ringing in the background when a conversation is going on. Or one thing I wrote down was his heart. She heard his heart crashing against his ribs like rough waters. And then Kamala making a strangling noise with her hands frozen in midair. So there you've got the sound and the visual at the same time. So it's very rich doing that. But it's also rich in culture, in Indian culture. And I can't judge how authentic it is, but it certainly seems authentic. And so I wondered what you want the listeners to take away from the culture that you're portraying.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, well, so two things I would say about that. One, in terms of the writing and in terms of being visual and very auditory, part of that to me is a lot about my process, which is to absolutely imagine a scene, right? That's when I am writing, I am seeing a scene unfold and I'm experiencing it moment to moment. I always have an idea of, I'd like the scene to do this, but sometimes it changes as I'm writing because of what's happening moment to moment. And I like to put my readers in that place. And also part of it is being in your body. It was really important to me in writing this that people that were reading it would feel very much in their bodies, because it is a kind of heady story about a diaspora, because there is a supernatural element, because there are a lot of things that could leave you untethered in this story, mm-hmm. I really wanted to root people into their bodies as they were reading. Part of that is just my writing style. Part of it was important for this story. And then the other thing that about Indian culture, you know, so when my parents moved to New Mexico in the late 60s, there were very few other East Indian families in Albuquerque, to the point that the only other couple, you know, families that were around became our instant family mm-hmm. and were there with us and are still the people that I think of as my cousins and my uncles and my aunts. And we're not actually related, but they are the people that I share all of my triumphs and disappointments with, and they are the people that knew me as a little girl, and that I feel this sort of this thing that I think that Americans who have family here feel for their blood relations, which is not necessarily understood to your deepest, you know, level of your soul, but rather just held, you know, kind of always held, loosely, tightly, but always held. And that was part of what I wanted to explain, was that immigrants don't often get to choose their family. When immigrants come here, whoever is around and viable becomes family in this very specific way. And it's a funny thing, because I think it brings together people that may not have actually had much in common back in India. And I would say that is true of my family. I mean, they're absolutely wonderful, and they're very understanding of each other, and they have old beefs and long history and shared laughs, but they're also, they have that thing that blood relations do, which is a little bit of a carelessness with each other, which I appreciate very much. And it's this kind of way of dealing with somebody that isn't very precious, because they're there. They are always there, and they will always be there. And I appreciate that we had that. And that's, I guess, what I was trying to bring to light in this, is how that kind of a family works for immigrants like my family.
Well, there's also the element that they all have left something else and chosen to do that, chosen to leave their home and their family and their culture and make a new life in a new culture in a different place. So that must mean there's some adventure in them, or some maybe hope for the future.
Absolutely. I think, though, you know, I mean, that's absolutely true. And I think anyone that stuck it out in America had to have a pretty resilient sense of adventure and sense of kind of going forward. Also, though, one of the things that was happening at that point in India was the diaspora of the late 60s and early 70s, in which many of the country's brightest, the sons and daughters that had been very well educated there and abroad, didn't have the infrastructure to hold them. So many of them wanted to go back to India, but there were no jobs for them.
No.
Or if they were jobs, they were not, in the kind of advanced field. And for Thomas, the surgeon in this book, there's nothing to support neurosurgery back at home. Whereas now that's almost a laughable idea. India is so technologically advanced, and specifically medically, I mean, you've heard about medical tourism. That particular problem has eased up. But for my parents and their generation, I think it really was devastating. I think a lot of them would have wanted to go home and just couldn't find a way to sustain themselves. And I think for their families, that was really a heartbreak too, because I think it was something that kind of happened all at once to many families. This idea that you send your child out, but they'll come home and they'll flourish mm-hmm. at home.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that they sent them out and they never came back.
Yeah.
And that was, I think, a real heartbreak for the country.
Well, what about the extent to which they preserved the culture, or they didn't preserve the culture? They sort of cling to their old ways as the mother did.
Yes. And there was Kamala, who clung to her old ways and did, you know, and had a lot of rituals around food, and mainly around food, because that was the thing that she excelled at. But never was the one of those women that used to be kind of ubiquitous as far as Indian culture goes, which I always thought of as the sneakers and saris, you know, the women that were wearing the sari but had the white sneakers. So
yes.
You knew that she had given some thought to being in America, but really only for the comfort of her feet. The rest of her was staying the same. Thank you very much. And Kamala was that kind of person who I think never really reconciled with being in America.
Yes.
And then I think there were others, however, that had, you know. There were others in that, like Sanji is this great character who is pretty happy with her place in America and pretty shouty and has a lot of declarations that she'll shove into, you know, any given chapter because she's found her place here and she's kind of living in a different way in America. And that's not something I explicitly discuss in the book, but it's a posture. It's a posture that each of the characters takes.
How do you think the book is going to be received in India? Did you worry about that?
That's a great question. You know, it's so funny because I was just on the phone today with a person from the Indian press, and I am really not sure. I mean, the truth is, I can't make a single sentence that India and America would agree on as a good sentence. So the idea that I have a whole book here is just, I think it's going to be, you know, great fodder for somebody to dismiss me wholeheartedly. But...
So you're prepared.
But the other thing is, yeah, I'm prepared. I've been prepared my whole life. I've been living with this my whole life. This is what it means to be an immigrant. You live with that. You live with that fear. But I will say, you know, so far they've been pretty thrilled with it. I think it's a story they haven't heard before, and then it's a story they've heard many times.
So oh,
I feel
good.
Like there are, you know, enough new elements that they can kind of find a different way in. Everyone seems very curious about the fact that it's funny. That it's a funny, funny read. Everyone says it's very funny. So that's kind of, I don't know if that's surprising for them. But I think that I'm curious about what they're going to think. And then in another way, I have really had to get used to this idea. And it wasn't just with writing. It was with every aspect of my personality that whatever I was going to be offensive to India or America or both. And that's just the way it's been, and that's probably the way it shall be.
Somehow it seems to me that Albuquerque, that being the other setting, that they would like that better, that it would make it easier than if it were New York, for instance, or Chicago or someplace like that. That's a little bit, because Albuquerque has elements that are familiar.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it's also, who doesn't love a story in the desert? I say this, mm-hmm. of course, as, you know, a person who will never stop being a New Mexican. But I feel like it's still so vast. It's still so underexplored in mainstream culture. And I feel like it's exciting to give people a desert story. Because frankly, just, you know, as you know, not the populations don't tend to go settle in the desert.
Well, I'm talking to Mira Jacob, and we're talking about her book, The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing, a book that's just come out. And I think it's time for you to read a section.
Okay, that's great. So I'm going to read a little bit of the prologue so you can hear some of the people in here. Prologue, A Chosen Madness, Seattle, June 1998. It was a fever, a hot rage of words. For three nights in a row, Thomas Eapen sat on the porch, one side of a furious conversation rolling over his tongue to spill out the window screen. The neighbors heard him. His wife, Kamala, could not sleep. Prince Philip, their aging and arthritic Labrador, had taken to pacing the hallway and whining. Kamala told her daughter all of this over the phone one early June evening, her voice as smooth as a newscaster's. I am thinking he's on his way out, Kamala concluded, and Amina pictured her father at the edge of the desert, waiting for a bus. Really? Who knows? My judgment is impairing. I haven't slept since Saturday. You're kidding. Not kidding, sniffed Kamala, whose ability to sleep through anything her insomniac husband could cook up, raccoon hunts, ditch fires, tractor mishaps, had long been a point of pride. Amina dropped her keys onto the kitchen counter. You're just now home from work? Kamala asked. Yeah. Amina placed the mail and her camera next to the keys. The answering machine blinked anxiously at her. Three nights? Seriously? How's work? Busy. Everyone in Seattle's getting married in the next month. You're not? Amina ignored her. What do you mean talking? Talking about what? Telling stories. What kind of stories? What kind of anything? Fits and nuts and now this man with his idiot yak-yak all the time. I told him his tongue would fall out and rot like one vegetable and still he won't shut up. You always say that. No, I don't. Ma. But this is different, Koche, Kamala sighed. Night noises snaked up through the phone line, pressing New Mexico right up to Amina's ear. The hushed applause of wind rolling through the cottonwoods. The hollow scritch of crickets echoing against the mesas. The click of the gate in the garden. Amina shut her eyes and felt herself in the darkening yard with the tickle of wild grass at the back of her knees. He's probably just talking to the dog, Ma. He does that all the time.
No, he's not.
How do you know?
I just told you. The dog is stuck outside whining, and besides, I heard him.
And?
And he was talking to Amachi.
Amina stopped moving. Her grandmother had been dead for almost 20 years.
Great. Okay, so now you're going to be going around doing readings and telling people about the book and sharing it with people, and you're going to be at Bookworks in Albuquerque on July 22nd.
Yes, 7 p.m.
7 p.m., okay. And
yep.
After that, after people receive the book, what's next for you?
Well, I think it's, you know, I what's next for me in terms of work is that I'm working on another novel. But right now, honestly, because it took 10 years to get this one out, I'm just sort of really enjoying this one reaching the world. It's been this amazing thing, and just, you know, it just came out last week, and it was a holiday weekend. And this incredible thing happened, which is that I guess a lot of people took it away with them for their holiday weekend. So
oh, great.
I got up today, and I had an inbox full of messages from people that frankly thought they weren't going to get through it because it seemed so long, and they said, I started reading and I didn't move and I read the entire thing in 2 days, and you know, and they feel really strongly about it, and that has been amazing.
That's great.
Has been really, yeah,
that's what I told you, the rhythm kind of gets to you.
Yeah,
it takes you up.
good.
But you already have a novel that you're working on, or that you have in mind?
Yes. Yeah. I have a novel I'm working on, and I'm just in the baby stages of that. I'm in the infancy and kind of doing the research. I'm doing all the other kind of creative stuff that I like to do here in Brooklyn.
And we should say that you have a son, and I loved the interview that he did on YouTube where he interviewed you.
Thank you. he's a character. He asked for a tuxedo for his 5th birthday.
Oh.
'Cause he's that guy. And so, if you look up the interview on YouTube, you will see a 5-year-old in a tuxedo asking me some very, very interesting questions.
So you have a son, and you also were involved in a literary...
Oh, it's a reading series, yeah.
Okay.
So what I did was, I have been here for a little more than 15 years, 16 years. And when I first came to New York and I was doing what everyone does when they try to write, which is working 1,000 jobs and writing, I realized really quickly that the writing life is pretty lonely. There's almost no room for celebration, or if you do, it comes and goes. And then there are a lot of books that never get the notice they should, which is such a heartbreak.
Mm-hmm.
So I started this reading series, and what we did was we paired a huge author with somebody that was less known at the time. So, you know, we would take Gary Steingart and put him with somebody that you maybe hadn't heard of, or, you know, Karen Russell, or somebody that, you know, people have a feeling about and want to come and see in this beautiful small space. And we would put them with somebody who was either had a brand new thing out, so you hadn't heard of them, or was under-recognized, whose books we had read and just thought, oh, this person's so good, they should have an audience. And it's a sweet night. It's a beautiful little stage, and everybody comes there. And frankly, you know, we've talked about how this took me 10 years. For me, that was sort of the church I went to every 2 weeks, the place that I went to kind of remind myself that stories were important and that writing was a viable way to kind of go through the world.
And were the big people willing to do it, willing to be sort of used that way?
I mean, I don't think we ever positioned it as, hey, come in here because, you know, we're going to get someone else to look at somebody who isn't you. That's never, that was a corollary. That was something that would hopefully happen. But frankly, the people that came to see Gary Steingart were thrilled to see Gary Steingart. The fact that we also had another agenda in getting them to see someone else, it wasn't something that would take away from the main writer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is it still going on?
Yeah, it is. I've handed it off to two young women, and they are really going forth with aplomb. They've set up a great season, and yeah, it's going on, and they still have this kind of great feeling in that space.
And will you be going back to another job, or are you going to spend your time writing?
You know, the entire time that I wrote this book, I was working some pretty high-powered corporate jobs, and it was actually just hellish. I would love to go back to a regular job. I would like it not to be the kind of corporate American grind that I was doing for the last 16 years. So I'm trying to kind of figure out how to do that. I'm in that point where if the book takes off, I can have a certain kind of life, and if it doesn't, I'm going to have another kind of life, and that's okay. I think what I have reconciled with is that really all I want to do is write another book. So whatever gets me there is what has to happen.
Well, I must say also that this book sort of speaks movie, and you already have the storyboard, as you say.
Yes, and I have had some interest, so I'm excited about that.
Wow, that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, wonderful. It's wonderful to hear about all these things happening. And congratulations on bringing the book out and finishing it and sort of winding it up so nicely so that it's such a good experience. It's such an interesting experience, and also it really involves you. When I was reading it, I had to keep saying to myself, it's just a story. Don't worry. It's just a story.
That's great to hear. Don't let it affect your mood.
So thanks for bringing it to New Mexico. I'm talking to Mira Jacob, and we're talking about her book, The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing, and she will be talking about it and signing it, I'm sure, at Bookworks on July 22nd in Albuquerque at 7:30, you said.
I'm just hoping to see a bunch of people there and faces, friendly faces and new faces. I'm really excited to come home.
Oh, I'm sure you are. It will be a nice experience to be kind of welcomed back to Albuquerque.
Yeah.
And of course, we have a number of authors who come from Corrales and have grown up in that experience of a sort of small community in Corrales.
Yes, of course. And Corrales, I have such a huge place in my heart, which is
fun. Okay, so we'll let people know that this is not exactly an autobiography at all.
There are obviously things that are generously drawn, but yeah, I also went out on a limb with some of it.
Okay,
me just doing that.
Yeah, well, I think we should let people know that because it's true.
Yeah.
Let's just spend the time enjoying the culture, the Indian culture and its mixture with Albuquerque and with Corrales. And that's the part I think is great. So thank you for bringing this to us. And we look forward to your next book.
Oh, thank you so much. And thanks for taking the time to talk to me about this. I hope I see you all. I hope I see you in July when I'm there.
Yes, July 22nd.